Former professor of European contemporary history at the University of Turin, Diana Carminati's eponymous book. Carminati's thesis in her recently published book was that the basic dynamics at work in Palestine are the same as those in US, Canada, and Australia history. These three countries and Israel are all, quote, settler colonial nations, and their plan since the one of their invasion was to get rid of all the people already on the land.
In my book, I've tried to describe how invaders get rid of entire populations by examining facts and evidence that took place in a span of time from the 70s to today. The strategy that has been adopted so far aims at gradually mollifying the people who were already on the land with subsidies and other in-kind benefits. The invaders get rid of those people, or at least concentrate them into increasingly shrinking areas, such as the Gaza Strip.
Academics pointed out that through a false narrative of manipulation, Western governments and media had been trying to persuade the public opinion that the start date of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is October 7, 2023.
Why do they lie so blatantly? The abomination began at the start of the last century when UK-backed Zionists sent their settlers to Palestine. After killings of Palestinians and unrest in 1947, an abusive UN resolution called for the partition of Palestine into Arab and Jewish states. Had the Palestinians been asked if they intended to share their land?
During his tour of the West Asia to bolster the United States' influence in the region, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan met the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia bin Salman on Wednesday to discuss the war in Gaza and future relations between Tel Aviv and Riyadh. Some experts believe that Israel's ongoing onslaught on Gaza has impacted the so-called Abraham Accords, putting it on hold. The genocide against Palestinians has pushed many to question the future of Arab countries' normalization of ties with Tel Aviv.
These accords were designed by the United States and Israel in an effort to create an anti-Iran bloc. I don't think this plan will succeed, also due to the role China is willing to play in the region. My take is that these accords won't go any further.
Also on Thursday, a protest by a group of pro-Palestine activists was held outside the headquarters of giant defense and aerospace group Leonardo in the Italian capital. Tens of people with banners and placards called on Leonardo to stop fueling a genocide in Gaza by providing weapons to Israel. Max Civili, Rome.
Amid Israel's relentless strikes on the Gaza Strip, many Afghans have gathered to show support for Palestinians. They vehemently denounced the Israeli regime's brutalities and showed their unwavering solidarity with Gaza. The demonstrators proudly brandished the flags of Palestine and displayed banners reading, "Down with Israel and down with USA."
This war is backed by the US. That's why it is still ongoing. Nowhere is safe in Gaza today. The Israelis bomb schools, they bomb buildings, they bomb hospitals with support from the US.
We have gathered here to call for the cessation of the oppression of the Palestinian nation. To stop the murder of women and children, all Muslims should unite and support Palestine. We are all willing to go to Gaza if made possible by our government.
While expressing their unwavering support for the Palestinian nation and their cause, the demonstrators also voiced their deep-seated frustration at the international community's failure in addressing this crisis and issued a stern condemnation of their inaction.
International organizations are just a tool to legalize horrible crimes committed by arrogant states. They have failed us in the case of Gaza, and this blot is on their hands too. We shouldn't expect such organizations to help, and we Muslims must take action.
Since October 7th, Israel has been committing genocide in Gaza. This demonstration is a ripple in the wave of protests that have taken place worldwide. They all chant the same message, that they stand united with Palestinians.
Through this gathering, Afghans are sending a strong message to the global community.
They underline that they stand by Palestinians and support them in the fight for their rights and freedom amid Israeli occupation and onslaughts. Abdullah Mirzad, Kabul.
The world's largest gathering dedicated to refugee issues. After 4 years holding its second meeting, bringing together member states, civil society, financial institutions, private companies, and more than 300 refugee advocates. An important participant, Iran. According to UNHCR data, as of mid-2023, the Islamic Republic has been the largest refugee-hosting country in the world.
There's no temporary solution to the refugee crisis. The UNHCR and the international community have to take serious measures for refugees to be able to go back home. The Islamic Republic of Iran has been hosting refugees for the longest time in history. Over the past 45 years, and even more recently since the developments in Afghanistan in 2021, my country is hosting the largest number of refugees in the world, providing them with health care services and education for their children, despite the fact that we are under harsh U.S. sanctions ourselves.
But while the protracted crises in places like Afghanistan, Myanmar, Syria, and Ukraine were discussed, the failure of the UN Security Council to confront the major human catastrophe in Gaza became the most important topic of the day, with a second meeting held on the sidelines of the Global Refugee Forum, focusing only on Gaza.
Women and children have been killed. The humanitarian ceasefire was violated by the Israeli regime. Today, the United States is openly supporting the killing of women and children by Israel. In the Middle East, we are witnessing further expansion of war, a war which, in any moment, would turn into explosion and get out of control.
More than half of Palestinians have had to leave their homeland, and they expect the UN pave the way for their return. The world is watching the people of Gaza as they are running out of time and options, facing bombardment, deprivation, and disease. Palestinians have been waiting for the UN to take action for over 75 years, and today they are facing the darkest chapter of their history since 1948.
The issue of Gaza remained on top of the agenda of Iran's foreign minister as he held bilateral meetings with his counterparts from Saudi Arabia, Japan, Indonesia, Tunisia, Kuwait, and Lebanon, as well as the Prime Minister of the Vatican, and most significantly, the High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, during which the humanitarian crisis in Gaza was discussed, as well as the tragic situation the world is facing in 2023 with an unprecedented number of displaced people. The UNHCR has announced that for the first time in history, the number of displaced people has surpassed 110 million, with over 36.4 million refugees. The Global Refugee Forum 2023 is hoping to provide an opportunity and the basis for the return of these refugees back home. Yusumi Shahmadi, Geneva.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavitah Waib. The U.S.-Israeli genocidal war has passed the grim milestone of over 20,000 deaths. Yet the U.S. is postponing a U.N. session for a possible ceasefire over semantics. This is while the Israeli Prime Minister has threatened again that the genocidal war will not stop until Hamas is eliminated. Now, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at where this war is heading, whether the U.S. is worried that Israel's loss will reflect negatively actually on its own power, in the face of the resistance groups in West Asia, such as Hezbollah. First, let me introduce our guests. Paula Rudy, co-founder of the Free Palestine Movement, joins us from Berkeley. Also joining us is Yves Zangler, author and political activist from Montreal. Welcome to you both. Paula Rudy, I'll first start with you. We're looking at the third time that the U.S. has rejected this resolution. The last time I checked, Thursday has started in New York. I don't know what time it is where you are, but I think it's where New York has to get together and for them to actually go through this. I'm looking at how every minute counts when it comes to this genocidal war. At the same time, we're looking at semantics here. I think it's over cessation that is the problem for the U.S. They are opting for suspension. How do you view and assess the way that the U.S. is positioning itself here when it comes to the U.N. which could result maybe in a possible ceasefire, temporary one at that?
Well, I'm not sure it's just about the semantics. It's also, I think, from what I've heard about the question of distribution and who supervises it and who controls it. And the ones who proposed this, the UAE and the other nations that are involved in drafting it, want the United Nations to be responsible for this. And I suspect that Israel wants more control over where the aid goes, and specifically they don't want it to go to northern Gaza, whereas the drafters of the resolution and the Palestinians are saying, no, it must be open to all of Gaza. So that there may be more to it than we know. We can't possibly be told everything about the negotiations that are happening behind the scenes.
Well, Yves Zangler, from the statements that are coming from Israel, it may somewhat be confusing because we have, for example, Isaac Herzog, who has said that they are ready and prepared for another ceasefire. But at the same time, the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu is that the war would not end while Hamas controls Gaza, and there's no talk of reducing the intensity, at least not in the coming weeks. What is your view about, first of all, even the notion of a ceasefire, given that Israel, last time around, once it ended, killed so many Palestinians, and this time around, based on the way that we're seeing that for it to have not happened already, but the way the Prime Minister Netanyahu is talking about it?
Yeah, well, I would presume that Israel is preparing itself or preparing to try a similar type, quote unquote, ceasefire or humanitarian pause or whatever we want to call what happened a few weeks ago. And they're under a lot of pressure internally to get more of the hostages back. And they're also under pressure internationally to allow humanitarian aid in, and also to slow down in the killing. So that's what I think the Israelis, you know, are sort of preparing for, and they're trying to, of course, get the best deal they can make with, you know, giving up as few Palestinians as they've kidnapped in exchange for those that Hamas has in Gaza. But I think the broader issue here is that, or what Netanyahu is speaking to, is that the murderous forces in charge of Israel want to be able to keep killing Palestinians. So whether that stops for a week and then, you know, continues for many months after, or just continues on without stopping for, you know, even a couple of days. That's clearly what Netanyahu wants. It's all framed as, you know, ending Hamas or destroying Hamas. That may be, you know, I think they would probably like that in some sort of theoretical sense of obviously killing as many Hamas officials and getting as many high officials of Hamas as possible. But really, this is about destroying Palestinian life in Gaza. And Hamas is just a sort of justification for this effort at destroying Palestinian life in Gaza, hopefully from a Zionist perspective, ethnically cleansing Palestinians. And they know, of course, that this level of killing that they're doing is just making Palestinians even more angry and hateful towards Israel. And so you know, even if they were to destroy Hamas, there's going to be a much more hostile resistance that's going to develop over the coming years.
Well, I mean, we're looking at about 75 days of this war to have transpired so far, Paulo Grudi. If you were to take a look at the accomplishments on the Israeli side when it comes to the battlefield, I'm not too sure what they can show for it. One of the things that stands out, obviously, at the top of the list, which is not an accomplishment, is the fact that 20,000 plus Palestinians have been murdered. So if the purpose is to defeat Hamas, this is going to take a long time. I mean, I'm no military analyst. But is that, I think Israel knows that that's not going to happen, but it's still selling that notion. Who are the buyers?
Very few people, I think, buy the idea that they're fighting Hamas. They're fighting the Palestinian people, and they want to see the Palestinian people disappear, as Eve has alluded to. And they want to see them disappear at least from the land where they are. If they go to other countries, that's fine with the Israelis. But actually, I think they would prefer to see them disappear from the face of the earth. This is genocide. This is ethnic cleansing. And I think that actually the death toll is far greater than what is commonly broadcast. It's much more than 20,000. There may be between 5 and 10,000 that are not counted because they don't have the names. Hamas, the Hamas government in Gaza, the health ministry, is keeping names of all them so that they can show that they are in fact 20,000 of them. But there are so many for whom they don't have the names because they're buried underneath the rubble, and they were children were trapped underneath the rubble, maybe staying alive for a while, but then dying in terror and pain. And we don't hear about those. But what about also the ones that are dying as a result of the sealing of the borders and the lack of food and the lack of medication and the disease that's happening because of Israel's acts? We don't even get statistics on people who are dying of diseases and starvation that we don't see. So the numbers are much greater than that, and it will become much greater if they don't get food and medical care.
You know, Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor of the U.S., visited Israel recently. Yves Zengler, I'm sure you're well aware of that. One of the things that he said is the fact that Israel needs to transition from high intensity to low intensity, which is quite startling given the fact that both entail Palestinians to be killed and murdered. But another thing that he said, based on an Israeli official, is that Sullivan said there was no pressure from Sullivan to end the fighting, but that he was concerned about the displacement of Palestinians and civilian casualties. So that does really show that the U.S. wants this war to continue. But why do you think the U.S. is so keen on that?
Well, I mean, the U.S. is, whether they say whatever they say, to some extent doesn't matter much, considering they continue to provide the weapons, you know, new shipments of weapons on an almost sort of multi-day basis to Israel. So if they want to restrict the killing, it's pretty simple to just stop either giving or selling weapons to Israel. So, yes, U.S. is absolutely completely complicit in this genocide. Now, what explains the U.S. Policy on this? I think that's a bit complicated in terms of, I mean, I think there's everything from the U.S. arms industry loves killing and love wars. That just is its market, and this has been a market for their weapons, and so that from that standpoint, I think the U.S. Obviously sees Israel as a geostrategic ally in the region that divides the region, and you know, bombs Syria regularly and bombs other countries in the region. I also think there's a very powerful Israel lobby within the U.S. There's a Christian Zionist element to it, and then there's a well-organized a Jewish pro-Israel network. Joe Biden has long, close connections to the Israel lobby. So I think that's the explanation is that this mix of arms industry, geostrategic thinking, and this powerful lobby pushes the U.S. government to basically support Israel almost no matter what.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
We need to figure out, if you can help us, Paula Rudy, as to what it is that will spell out an endgame here. Now, what the U.S. has said, out in the open, is not what Israel wants. The U.S. wants what it calls a recalibrated, reformed PA. I'm not too sure what a recalibrated or reformed PA would look like, but for that is what the option the U.S. seems to be leaning on, because that's what they're envisioning. Where Israel is saying, we want to handle the security. What do you think it is that either are going to, agree on? Because they both seem to, Israel obviously has a say, and U.S. is putting its two cents in there. And I'm saying that taking into account that Hamas cannot be defeated, as we spoke earlier about that. So if you can put that into the equation for us and explain to us what may happen.
Yes, this is not about an agreement. If you're talking about how to end the fighting and the resistance, it's not about an agreement between the United States and Israel, or between Israel, the United States, and the rest of the world. It's about the Palestinians. The Palestinians must have their voice. They must be satisfied. They are not going to go back to the situation as it was before. Hamas has clearly declared that, and it seems to me that they are doing very, very well in pursuing their strategy. And they can probably hold out for a very, very long time. I'm not sure that Israel can hold out for a very long time. Their economy is in the trash. And a 500,000 Israelis have already left the country. A large percentage of their population is not living in the places where they used to live in the south and in the north. And they're very dissatisfied with what the government is doing. I don't think Israel can last that long. And Hamas is counting on that. So it's about Hamas, and they will not go back to the situation where they are living in a an open-air concentration camp, and where their government, their existing government, is taken away from them, and some slave government is put in place to control them, so that the Israelis have more control in the future than they've had until now. That's not going to happen. So if you want, looking for an end of it, the end of it coincides with the end of the Zionist state, where there's one state for everyone with equal rights. That's it. That's the only peace terms that is going to end this situation. Okay.
Well, one thing that is definitely, propelling and increasing the chances of Israel's economy taking an even larger hit is a front, perhaps, that was not anticipated, Eve Zangler, and that is the one with Yemen, of which we have seen what they have done when it comes to the maritime transit in the Red Sea, where at this point any Israeli-linked vessel, I'm sure you're well aware of it, is being targeted. We just had in our news what was confirmed, 80 to 85% of the port of Eilat has ceased to function in terms of the little amount that they did. At the same time, some are reporting that there's really no chance of any type of vessel going there. And there are other countries that are suffering as a result of this. And the militarization of this Red Sea area by the U.S. and its so-called coalition is adding more worry economically. Do you think that this angle or part of this U.S.-Israeli genocidal war may lead to the end of the war where Israel needs to put up the white flag?
There's no doubt that this puts pressure on Israel. That the Houthis definitely they have ramped up the pressure. Obviously, there's also some pressure with regards to Hezbollah. But yes, I think that is the case. I think that's this, it's clearly scared a lot of the global capitalist world. There's major shipping companies that have said they won't be taking Israeli products. There's others that have decided to take different routes, which cost a lot more. The U.S. is clearly very scared. My government, the Canadian government, has formally joined this coalition that's basically countries that are not from the region, militarily intervening. I guess they have Bahrain as a little bit of cover. But this is definitely one of the things the U.S. was trying to avoid when it you know greenlit the genocidal policies in Gaza back in mid October. That's why the U.S. was sending more naval vessels. It was trying to pressure any other forces in the region to not defend Palestinians. Where this all could go, obviously, this has the possibility of escalating, even further and drawing in other countries and a wider war. But it's the demand that the General Assembly made, the vast majority of the General Assembly for a ceasefire. I mean, that's the way to go. Israel has to stop its killing. And then that will lead to less problems with regards to shipping. But of course, the U.S. is going to do everything it can to make sure that there isn't that type of pressure on Israel, both economically within Israel and kind of more broadly that flows from the disruption of shipping.
So when we talk about other fronts, there's one that has been escalating, albeit at a controlled manner, but it's still increasing in its intensity, and that is the one with Lebanon. What is going on there, do you think? What will happen, Paula Rudy? We know, here again, we're looking at two different scenarios that's put out there. One, Israel saying, no, we don't want this to expand with Hezbollah, but then you have other officials saying, no, we need to go after Hezbollah. We need to purge that area out. The U.S. says it does not want to also have this to elevate into that phase. What is the deal there? What do you think they want from that?
Well, Hezbollah has also said that they don't want to escalate it in any further, but both sides are saying that they're willing to escalate it. I think escalation would be a bigger problem for Israel than it would be for Hezbollah. Hezbollah will face some internal problems in Lebanon as a result of escalation, but they can do it. And with the proper provocation from Israel, which Israel seems willing to give them, then they can justify it to the rest of Lebanon. So nobody really knows. The Israelis don't know. The Lebanese don't know where this is leading. But it could definitely lead to an expansion, and we don't know how big an expansion, even beyond the borders of Lebanon and Israel.
And my final question goes to you here, Yves Zangler. We're taking a look at the way that Israel's standing has pretty much been decimated. Not to mention the U.S. Israel has brought the U.S. down with it in this genocidal war. Has Israel lost legitimacy on the world stage when it comes to the way that countries are going to be dealing with Israel, whether it's through trade or through diplomatic means?
Certainly in terms of popular opinion around the world, it's pretty clear is very hostile to what what Israel's doing, even in a country like Canada, that's the case. Whether it leads to long-term ramifications on trade and stuff like that, the U.S. is still very powerful. NATO is still very powerful. They back Israel. This has clearly been very damaging for U.S. Standing within the Middle East. And I think more generally, I mean, the statement's coming from the South African leader about this being a genocide. So probably large swaths of Africa as well, to a certain extent in Latin America. But whether this leads to, long-term effects on trade and things like that, I think that comes back to, whether there are the forces that, care about human beings and oppose genocide in Europe, in the Middle East, in North America, whether those forces keep mobilizing and keep denouncing what Israel's done. Even months after the worst of the killing ends. Israel's a powerful country. Let's be clear about that. It is a powerful country. It has its own internal divisions. And I think when all is said and done, those divisions in the current phase of killing, I think those divisions are going to be worse. They're going to be further exacerbated within Israel. How that plays out in the kind of medium term, I don't know. It's clear that Israel has lost here in North America, in the belly of the beast. Israel has lost the younger generation. That's absolutely clear. Public opinion has turned overwhelmingly. And, public opinion in the Middle East was always hostile to Israel, and it's just become much more hostile. It's going to be harder for the different governments to normalize. The longer term ramifications, I don't know at this point.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you, Yves Zengler, author and political activist from Montreal. Paul Arudi, a pleasure, co-founder of Free Palestine Movement from Berkeley. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tavoy and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program at FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to our latest episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In today's episode, we will complete explanation of Surah Ma'arij, which we had started a few weeks ago. Number 70 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran, this surah has 44 ayahs and was revealed in Mecca. Although, according to exegetes, some of its ayahs were revealed in Medina. The title of the surah derives from the word Ma'arij mentioned in ayah 3 regarding the places of ascent or lofty stations where, by the permission of the Almighty Creator, angels can ascend. The surah focuses on the Day of Resurrection and warns the polytheists and disbelievers of the dire consequences of their lack of faith, while defining the characteristics of the people of paradise and hell. The opening ayahs concern the sending down of torments in this world, such as the one that befell a denier of the divinely designated velayat or leadership of the Prophet's immaculate cousin and son-in-law, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. We start from where we left you last week, and here are ayahs 36, 37, 38, and 39.
فَمَا لِلَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا قِبَلَكَ مُهْطَعِينَ عَنِ الْيَمِينِ وَعَنِ الشِّمَالِ عَزِينَ أَيَطْمَعُ كُلُّ امْرِئٍ مِّنْهُمْ أَنْ يُدْخَلَ جَنَّةَ نَعِيمٍ كَلَّا إِنَّا خَلَقْنَاهُمْ مِمَّا يَعْلَمُونَ
What is the matter with the faithless that they scramble toward you? From the right and the left in batches? Does each man among them hope to enter the garden of bliss? Never. We indeed created them from the base of matter, what they know. If you might recall, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah last Friday, we said belief in the Day of Resurrection and the Final Judgment is the key to salvation, and thus a true believer is always cognizant of God Almighty while aware of the rights of others in his or her wealth, especially of the poor and the needy, since the path to paradise is adherence to divine decrees, observance of the ritual prayers, abstinence from sins, and positive interaction with others. The ayahs that we recited to you now point to the wishful thinking of the polytheist and other disbelievers that their better standard of life in the world will ensure for them a place in paradise in case there is the resurrection day, in which they do not actually believe while scoffing at the concept of paradise. So what makes the sinners and disbelievers who lead a depraved and desultory life think of themselves as superior to others when they know fully well that all human beings are created from a worthless and unclean drop, and it is only the correct set of beliefs, coupled with virtuous deeds rather than wealth, that ensures salvation in the hereafter. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, the unmatched eloquence and timeless wisdom of the Noble Quran made even those who mocked and belied the Prophet to listen to its recitation, not out of belief, but in the wishful longing for paradise on the basis of their wealth and power. Number two, a true believer is never boastful of his deeds and is always humble before the Almighty Creator. And number three, arrogance and vanity are restrained when a person thinks of his or her common origin from a worthless and unclean drop of liquid. We invite you to listen to ayahs 40 and 41 of the same surah.
فَلَا أُقْسِمُ بِرَبِّ الْمَشَارِقِ وَالْمَغَارِبِ إِنَّا لَقَادِرُونَ عَلَىٰ أَن نُبَدِّلَ خَيْرًا مِّنْهُمْ وَمَا نَحْنُ بِمَسْبُوقِينَ.
Therefore, I swear by the Lord of the East and the West that we are able to replace them by better than them, and we are not to be outmaneuvered. Here Allah swears by the East and the West in plural rather than singular form in order to emphasize the different points of sunrise and sunset every day of the year, which is obvious for anyone keen on scientific calculations of the cardinal points that become fully evident even for ordinary persons at the time of the winter and summer solstices, when the sun reaches its zenith in the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn, respectively. Besides these two distinct solstices on December 22nd and June 21st, which mark the longest night and the longest day, vice versa, in the southern hemisphere, there are two spring and autumn equinoxes on March 21st and September 22nd, respectively, when the day and the night are of equal duration. These scientific facts, in accordance with the Earth's orbit around the Sun as it rotates on its axis, were proven by the Noble Quran over 14 centuries ago. This is to awaken human conscience to the power of the Almighty Creator, who, as the next ayah says, can easily replace the wrongdoers with better ones, and is able to resurrect all humanity from even scattered bones and dust for the judgment day. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, the Noble Quran, though not a book of astronomy, mentions scientific facts with accuracy in order to point to the spherical shape of planet Earth and its orbit around the sun. And number two, we must never consider ourselves better than others, thinking that Allah has not created anyone superior to us, since He is able to replace us by others. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, let us listen to ayahs 42, 43, and 44, marking the end of Surah Ma'arij as well.
فَذَرْهُمْ يَخُوضُوا وَيَلْعَبُوا حَتَّى يُلَاقُوا يَوْمَهُمُ الَّذِي يُوعَدُونَ يَوْمَ يَخْرُجُونَ مِنَ الْأَجْدَاثِ سِرَاعًا كَأَنَّهُمْ إِلَى نُصُبٍ يُوفِضُونَ خَاشِعَةً أَبْصَارُهُمْ تَرْهَقُهُمْ ذِلَّةٌ ذَلِكَ الْيَوْمُ الَّذِي كَانُوا يُوعَدُونَ
So leave them to gossip and play until they encounter their day, which they are promised, the day when they emerge from the graves, hastening as if racing towards a target, with a humble look in their eyes, overcast by abasement. This is the day they had been promised. These closing ayahs of Surah Ma'arij warn the obdurate disbelievers who mock the prophets, their moral guidelines, and the day of resurrection, of the terrible shock in store on the promised day, when mankind will emerge from the graves and raise in a bewildered state. The prophet is asked to leave the intransigent disbelievers to their fate, after his relentless endeavors to awaken their conscience through presentation of rational facts. On the day of resurrection, the disbelievers will be the real losers, with their eyes lowered, with fear, owing to the intensity of horror of the surroundings, with humility, while they shall be enwrapped by ignominy and humility. From these ayahs, we learn the following points. Number one. Guidance is necessary till a certain stage, after which the intransigent disbelievers should be left to their own fate. Number two, emergence from the graves means physical resurrection of all the dead. And number three, the day of resurrection has been promised with certitude by the Almighty Creator, so we ought to be prepared for it through good deeds. Dear listeners, next week we will start with Surah Nuh, which refers to the mission of Prophet Noah. Dear listeners, goodbye and God bless you.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.